are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, June 6th, 2019. I'm Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report, broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Brian Mayer, reporter for Telesur, co-editor of the Brazil Wire. There have been massive uprisings and protests across Brazil taking on the Bolsonaro government already 5 months in, with the lowest approval ratings of any presidency at this historical juncture in Brazil. Clown fascism is faltering, plus new revelations on the political persecution of Lula da Silva, a legal wiretapping of his lawyers by the Lava Jato team. We're going to be talking about all that, plus Bolsonaro's ecological policies. They're calling him the exterminator of the future. But can we learn from the uprising in Brazil as we take on authoritarians in the United States and globally? Speaking of, the United States is threatening tariffs against Mexico. Trump still saying that Mexico is not doing enough to support this war on migration, and a new report that ICE and border agents are taking away the medications of teenagers that they're detaining.
Jesus.
As the terrorism of the Trump administration continues at a steady pace. Donald Trump is incredibly unpopular in key swing states. Don't get complacent, stay focused, but his numbers are plummeting in New Hampshire, Wisconsin, Michigan, Arizona, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and even Florida, and several others. Saudi Arabia is buying new missile technology from China. The African Union has suspended the Sudan as the military has been in a vicious crackdown, deploying gangsters to murder students and protesters, as it says. You can get rid of al-Bashar, but not the al-Bashar system. It isn't just Joe Biden that's opposed funding, federal funding for abortion. In fact, all members of Congress running, except for Bernie Sanders, have voted for federal bans. A 1972 article surfaces of Bernie Sanders supporting abortion rights and condemning men controlling women's bodies before Roe v. Wade even happened.
He's so good.
He's, in fact, really good. Joe Biden is really bad. He worked to undermine the Affordable Care Act's coverage of contraception. Elizabeth Warren rips into him for backing the Hyde Amendment. And the Democratic National Committee has opted out of a climate change focus debate, because why would the future viability of life on Earth be something you'd want your presidential contenders to discuss? Juan Guaido and I have one similarity. We both rely on astrologers for our political guidance. I'm just kidding. Steven Crowder has been, I'm not totally sure, actually, the state of his demonetization of YouTube, but YouTube is running through thousands of channels. F Crowder, but this isn't the answer either. We need a actual governmental but also journalistic strategy so independent creators are not destroyed and undermined. But it's not Carlos Mencia's fault. It's Steve Crowder and Google's fault. I'll explain that and more on today's Majority Report. Brendan, very good job on the board.
Oh, thank you.
I would just like to provide a little bit of positive reinforcement. Can we do, what's that like? Is it like the Four Seasons? Somebody should do, part of our great creative army. Somebody should, I don't actually know if you see Sam's hand when he's doing the down or up in that kind of way. If you do, you should put like the Four Seasons underneath it or something. I think that would be very funny.
Yeah, he's a conductor.
I think that's memeable. Jamie is here. Brendan is here. Matt is hopefully getting some good fun times and restoration on his little mini vacation. How's everybody doing?
I'm pretty okay today. I listened to a really good episode of Pod Damn America on my way here. Shout out to Jake. And I was in TOPO getting a breakfast sandwich, and I saw Meghan McCain's face on the television. And I was like, oh, maybe I should listen to what she's saying, because maybe we'll talk about it today on the show. And then I was like, you know what? I'm off the clock right now. I'm going to listen to the people I want to listen to, and it's not her.
Wise life choice. Brendan, any similar choosing to not listen to Meghan McCain and perhaps listen to like a Cormac McCarthy Audible or something instead?
No, I kind of like The View. It kind of gives you an insight into what everyone else is thinking.
I think, like The View, too.
Yeah, sometimes we get a little bit, you know, buried in our corner of the world.
Kind of
come up and hear what all the moms are talking about. Ask the moms.
I also should have asked the moms. I neglected to mention that there's major legislation in the works here in New York State on rent control, which we'll get into later as well. Rent control is going to be one of the major issues that is going to need to emerge, obviously, on a state and local level. And as we talk about pushing and expanding the portfolio of what candidates like Sanders and Warren are offering, I want to see universal public housing option. And I also want to see incredibly aggressive pushes for rent control. But being that as it may, Bernie Sanders, as everybody knows, was at the Walmart Board of Directors meeting yesterday. And before he even set foot in the building, if I understand, or maybe when he arrived, certainly before he spoke, the CEO of Walmart already endorsed a increase in the federal minimum wage. Now, of course, I don't think there was a dollar number assigned to it. It was a we should look at sort of thing. And of course, the CEO knows that with the Republicans controlling the Senate and Donald Trump in the White House, a move to help people live better is obviously not going to happen. But this is the power of Bernie Sanders. And this is the power of any frontline, top level national politician who is willing to not only advocate important and great policies, but literally function as a labor and community organizer. It's an incredibly powerful thing. Could you imagine when this man is president? It's one thing to talk about bully pulpit power. This is literal organizing power. Here he is after coming out of the shareholder meeting, and he is going to explain to this reporter, I believe his name is Ryan Nobles, that the Walton family has still not heard the message.
Do you feel that the Walmart CEO got your message today?
No, I don't. I think if he got the message, what he would say is that we are going to do what many of our competitors are doing, what Amazon has already done, what Costco has done, what Target is moving toward, and raise that minimum wage to $15 an hour. Look, this is not a radical idea. You got the wealthiest family in our country worth $175 billion. Surely they can afford to pay their employees a living wage.
Now, he did say that they do believe the federal minimum wage
should
be
raised. Well, that's right. We are working on it. I led the effort in the Senate to raise the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour. We got strong Republican opposition there. In the House, I hope they will do it. But with Republicans controlling the Senate, there is no guarantee we will succeed. What we need is Walmart, the largest private sector employer in this country, to take a bold step forward and say that all of their employees should live with dignity.
And how would you respond to some of the things they've said they've done for their employees? You think it's enough?
No, it's not enough. Look, I'm not here to, you know, criticize everything that they have done. All that I'm saying is that if you work 40 hours a week in the United States, especially in a company owned by the wealthiest family in America, a company which has apparently enough resources to pay its CEO over $20 million a year in compensation, 1,000 times more than what the average worker makes, you know, if you can do all of that, you can pay your workers a little.
There's no doubt about that. And I just want to really emphasize the nothing radical about $15 minimum wage. Okay, so let's take this in a couple of different steps. A broader argument is an institution like Walmart should be broken up, decentralized, that even in a much better economy and society, there's certain forms of frictionless production in a place like Amazon, which are fundamentally incompatible with ecological sustainability and humane worker practices, even in a much more democratized environment. So one is break up these companies, democratize these companies, have democracy at the workplace, as Professor Richard Wolff talks about. That's the long-term goal. I would say the short-term goal and the next horizon to push, and one way is breaking this up geographically, because $15 an hour is not going to get you where you need to be in the Bay Area or New York City or Seattle or Chicago. But the other way, frankly, and you know, again, you can always have caveats carved out and subsidies. In fact, Walmart can pay the subsidies in taxes that subsidize the bodega that literally can't afford to pay somebody $15 an hour. So these are all solvable. And the question of how to solve them is always about taking resources that are concentrated up here and breaking them up and bringing them down so they flow out. The answer is actually always quite simple. But I would say that, you know, if you are a Target, an Amazon, a Walmart, any of these major monopolistic or monopolistic tendency conglomerates, we should set a baseline that you pay your workers $35 an hour, period. Whether you're in the middle of the Ozarks or whether you're in the center of Manhattan, you have to pay what would translate to some form of a legitimate, at least lower middle class wage, period.
Yeah. And if there are places like New York City where unions are stronger and can organize for more than that,
absolutely.
Pay people more than that in New York City. But you're right. The floor should be like at least $30 an hour.
At least 30, 35 bucks an hour, no doubt, for any company like that with that type of profits. And speaking of, you know, what Walmart has done, and Bernie politely saying, obviously, not remotely enough, let's go to sound number 13, where a worker at this same rally, she's going to explain her experience as a human being working for this company.
A week in my shoes, taking care of my four children alone, and tell me that you can work for your crap money. Worrying if I'm going to be able to take my kids to the doctor if they need to, because I don't have the money to fix my car. They've never lived in our shoes. They don't know what we're going through. And this is America. What is wrong with us? We're supposed to take care of our people, and we're not. And these companies make all this money, and we're struggling. Why? We don't have to struggle. That's why we have people like Senator Sanders on our side, because he believes that too.
And really just my final question, looking around, you are not alone today.
No. No. No.
No, it's a tough question. How is it to know that you have others who are here also in support of everything that's going on?
It's amazing because I have people nationwide that are my family now.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to say?
Thank you, Bernie!
Thank you, Bernie!
Such a pleasure. Thank you. Of
course. That's organizing. That's solidarity. That's, I believe, Cornel West. He says that justice is love in public.
Oh,
that's it.
That touched my cold communist heart.
That's the reason you have a communist heart.
Indeed.
So let's...
Touched my warm communist heart.
Your warm communist heart. And there's nothing wrong with having a heart, in fact. My heart doesn't care about your libertarian nonsense corporate cuck ideology. We're going to take a brief break, and we will be back with Brian Mayer of Brazil Wire.
So glamorous, you can blame me for feeling amorous. Wonderful, marvelous, that you should care for me.
Back to the Majority Report. If you're listening on a podcast, you will hear what was Jal Gilberto. Very appropriate music for today's show. Joining us now is an essential voice for understanding all things Brazil, and I would say through Brazil, the global left. Brian Mayer is a reporter for Telesur English. He's the co-editor of the Brazil Wire and also editor of, I believe it is The Year in Lead, Year of the Coup in the Making, which is an incredible anthology of articles that have been published in Brazil Wire on what happened leading up to the rise of Bolsonaro and the political imprisonment of Lula. I was honored to write the foreword to that incredible book. Brian, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So, Brian, out of the gate, 5 months in, we know how horrible Bolsonaro is, and you could remind people of his record and what he is doing with regards to labor, indigenous people, the environment, all of this. But, you know, to the extent there's even just an objective analysis here, how's he doing? How's he doing 5 months in? Is he popular?
He's currently at the 2 month mark, the least popular new president since the end of the dictatorship. Okay, and that's a pretty impressive feat. If you look at the gallery of bums who've held the office of presidents since the dictatorship, you know, like José Sarney, who ended his mandate so unpopular that he couldn't go out on the streets without people throwing rocks at him.
Jesus. Why is Bolsonaro, and in addition to, obviously, of course, he's, you know, okay, so he's pursuing obviously policies that are detrimental to most people, which are right-wing policies. But that being said, I mean, he ran on this same authoritarian right-wing populist wave, which won in the United States, which is winning across the world, speaking to people's bigotries, but also their anxieties and also their kind of sense of fear and terror and paranoia. And then there's different factions inside the Bolsonaro government. There's the neoliberal privatizers, there's the military, then there's the alt-right people. What direction is he going in, and what has made it so that even the people in his core are starting to be dissatisfied with him?
Okay, well, first of all, you know, I mean, the main reason he won was because the elections were illegitimate. I mean, they removed the leading candidate.
Right.
Lula was polling with over twice the popularity as him and would have clearly won the election. And on top of that, they committed election fraud against Fernando Haddad, you know, who also would have won. And also all of this Steve Bannon supported social media crimes they committed. Mm-hmm. So Brazil's always had a core, maybe 20-25% of the population that has fascist tendencies, you know, dating back to the original fascists in the 30s. There's always this group of people who support the police's right to kill anyone they want, which is what Lula's captor Sergio Moro is trying to push through now, a law that will allow police to shoot anyone if they feel scared. But what happened during the elections was this surge of illegal WhatsApp activity, you know, that bombarded people who weren't very political with really negative and slanderous messages, basically calling Fernando Haddad a pedophile and things like that, and photoshopped images. And so he never had that much of a mandate to begin with. Now, he took office. He was supported, you know, about 55% of the Brazilian population were rooting for it to work, for things to work out. So he had like a 55% approval rate. That's now dropped to 26% mm-hmm. in the first two months in office. And the reason is because, first of all, he's an idiot. He doesn't have any speaking skills. He refused to participate in any of the debates, you know, mm-hmm. except for the first one, which he was humiliated in. You know, he's so socially awkward that he insisted on sitting down the entire time in the one debate he was in where everyone else was standing. Mm. You know, like he's just like completely socially awkward, not very bright. There's growing scandals involving his kids. It's looking more and more like his son Flavio was somehow involved in the assassination of Marielle Franco. Bolsonaro's wife's uncle was just arrested for being in a paramilitary militia in Brasilia, for being a leader of a militia.
Talk more about the case of the connections that we don't know yet. The you know, obviously it's still being reported, but there are there's the assassination of Marielle Franco, and maybe you could remind people of Marielle Franco. She's a very important figure, obviously, and a martyred figure. And then there's also this broader connection between the Bolsonaro government and the Bolsonaro family with these paramilitary gangs that operate on a nexus with the Brazilian police and so on. And let me just tack on to that also. The very scary thing about that, too, is it mirrors in some ways Colombia, right, where a lot of the sort of dirty work of right-wing governments and the police state is outsourced to paramilitaries and drug gangs that are affiliated with them. And it seems to be that there's a kind of similar model in Bolsonaro's Brazil.
Well, that's kind of like what it's looking like, really. I mean, the militias normally, like, for the militias are a recent thing. You know, they started in the 2000s, and to date, most of them, I mean, you've had like death squads. You have a long history of death squads in Brazil, which are very similar to militias, except the difference between the militias and the death squads is the militias have, like, they don't just kill people. They actually control territory, and they set up extortion rackets and squeeze local business owners out of money and make all the people living in that neighborhood buy cooking gas from them and buy their pirate cable TV service. And in return for that, they protect that neighborhood against crime. You know, that's how they started out. So they're a little bit different than death squads, which historically have just been like committing assassinations for politicians and things like that. But it's basically been a Rio de Janeiro thing. But now it looks like it's spreading because Michel Bolsonaro's uncle was in – they just uncovered one operating in Brasilia. So this does look like it's spreading across Brazil a little bit. Not that much yet, because in a lot of cities, the drug gangs still have a really firm grip on things. But basically they're organized crime groups made up of police officers. Mm-hmm. You know, normally military police, sometimes firemen. And it's either like ex-cops or current cops working on their days off. And they're, you know, extremely right-wing. They're a living legacy of the fascist, neo-fascist military dictatorship, ideologically. Like, if you live in a neighborhood where the militia controls it, right, they beat teenagers up who dye their hair. You know, they shoot people for smoking marijuana and stuff like that. They're just super reactionary and right wing. And what Bolsonaro's ethos is like he stands for all of their values. Okay. Right. And it's coming out, you know, more and more evidence showing that it was one of these militias from Rio das Pedras community in Rio de Janeiro that was behind the assassination of Marielle Franco. And the mother and the wife of the head of this militia were employees in State Congressman Flavio Bolsonaro's cabinet for 10 years.
And that's Bolsonaro's son. Yes. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So that this is, and then they arrested the shooter, right? Mm-hmm. And he was living two doors down from Jair Bolsonaro in this luxury condo complex. You know, he's a retired police officer. How could he afford to live in a millionaire luxury condo complex? And they found over 100 machine guns in one of his properties.
Yep.
And these are the exact kinds of guns that Bolsonaro just tried to legalize through issuing a decree without going through Congress.
Right. So and you also mentioned that the very specific steps that Sergio Moro, who, of course, was the lead, the persecutor of Lula, who then took a job as Bolsonaro's justice minister, the Bolsonaro government, and also politicians and affiliated with him to formally legalize not only greater ability for police to kill people, which is already a massive problem to begin with in Brazil and places like the favelas and the periphery, and then also rules that are frankly they're analogous to like the stand your ground rules that ALEC has pushed in the United States, making it easier for farmers to kill people that happen to walk across their land, as an example. So there's this giant put, and we've already seen these spikes. There was a story of a Brazilian musician, I believe, a couple of months ago, who was murdered with his family in his car. So this type of thing is spiking and being pushed explicitly as policy.
Yeah, exactly. And also Moro's pushing his crime package, which he's been unable to pass until now, thank God. You know, it also includes all these measures to protect militias.
Right.
Okay, so he's not an anti-corruption crusader that publications like ASCO as America's Quarterly, New York Times, and all these other publications tried to pretend he was while he was persecuting Lula. He's not. He doesn't care about corruption at all. He's trying to make it harder to arrest militias, militia leaders, right?
And in fact, so my read is, and correct me if I'm wrong too, that so when we talk about drug gangs running neighborhood, the militias are going up against the drug gangs. And again, in an analogy to Colombia, not only are you not dealing with a drug and violence problem, the militias then just, in addition to their reactionary politics and their own viciousness, just like the drug gangs, they take over those same drug distribution networks as well. So a lot of them are also implicated in drug business.
Well, it's happening a little bit in Rio. Yeah. In some militia-controlled territories, they don't allow any drugs.
Okay.
But in Rio das Pedras, I know that they've made a partnership with the Command Vermelho, which has a partnership with the PCC, which has a partnership with the Calabria Mafia, and they're setting up drug dealing tables in certain spots in public in that favela area, which I've actually spent a lot of time in. I actually filmed on a BBC documentary called Welcome to Rio. One of our characters was from that neighborhood, and I actually met some of the militia people at that time and kind of have a pretty decent knowledge of how they operate because of that.
Before we get to these incredible counter-protests and the real incredible activity of resistance of the Brazilian left on the streets, particularly around these education protests in the past couple of weeks, can you just really quickly remind everybody who Marielle Franco was? Because I do think it's important, you know, in addition to noting her assassination, how important and unique she was in not only Brazilian but international politics and activism.
Well, Marielle Franco was an Afro-Brazilian, lesbian, socialist city councilwoman who was from a favela. You know, and it's a very rare type of personality who would get elected to public office in Brazil, which has so many class and race issues. And she was someone who, because, like, you know, the biggest problem, you look at Black Lives Matter in the U.S., mm-hmm. and how much people have mobilized and everything. Imagine if there was a city in the U.S. where the police were killing 4 black people a day. That's what's going on in Rio de Janeiro right now, right? So Marielle Franco, while she was in city council, she made an issue of going after police violence and going after the militias and opening investigations against them. And she was she wasn't anti-police. She also pushed through legislation to provide more financial support to the families of slain police officers. I mean, she wasn't like, she was trying to address the problem the best way possible. She wasn't like saying, oh, declare war against the police or something like that. And that's pretty much seems to be why she was killed, because she was directly confronting these militia people. But she's also turned into a symbol of everything that the Bolsonaro administration hates.
Right.
Everything that these fascists hate, a gay black woman from a favela, you know?
Right.
So this is why she's turned into this kind of symbol. And I met her once. She was super, super nice. Before she was a city councilwoman, she was working in the office of a state congressman, Marcelo Freixo, and I was going to meet him, and I spent like an hour and a half waiting for him. And she was super nice to me the whole time. And I just remember her being super nice person.
What has been happening in the last couple of weeks? There's been demonstrations and pushback the whole time, but it seems like in the last couple of weeks that it's been sort of a watershed moment with a couple of different factors. Bolsonaro trying to push through a whole set of policies that would completely gut and devastate education in Brazil, privatize it, eliminate departments, and also the ability, finally, after being silenced in solitary confinement, of President Lula speaking, and then these massive protests against the budget cuts and against the education attacks from Bolsonaro. So start us, I guess, by talking about the education stuff first. What is Bolsonaro trying to push through, and what have the protests looked like on the streets across Brazil?
Okay, well, basically what Bolsonaro is trying to do is privatize higher education. Now, when Lula was president, they built 17 new free public universities and over 120 new campuses to these public universities across the country. And they doubled the education budget. And then when Dilma Rousseff was president, she passed a measure to tie all profits from the state petroleum company to public education and health, right? So they invested heavily in it. And Tamar started taking it all down. He canceled the law about the petroleum profits. He froze education spending for 20 years. And so
Temer's the president who took over after the coup that removed Dilma in 2016, the congressional coup. Okay, go ahead. Just want to let people know.
He already crippled the public university system. You know, like he cut scholarships in half. He canceled this program called Science Without Borders that would send over 100,000 students for years abroad in the best universities in the world, like Harvard and places like that. And Bolsonaro came in. Now, his economics minister is one of these 1970s Milton Friedman protégés from University of Chicago who worked in Pinochet's Chile for a decade. And his sister is president of the Brazilian National Distance Learning Federation. And so this is like everyone's looking at this as like an attempt to cripple the public school system so that more and more people will start getting these – Cracker Jack box diplomas from these for-profit distance learning schools.
So this is Betsy DeVos. I mean, this is exactly what Betsy DeVos and Paul Ryan and
she's probably friends with them. Right. Well, she's probably friends with Betsy DeVos.
Right.
And so, but when he announced this, this was like people were just saying this was the last straw. You know, this was the in Portuguese they said this is the drop of water that became a tsunami. Mm. And so immediately. Bolsonaro was giving a speech at a public high school in Rio, and thousands of kids gathered out in front of it booing him. And then the organized left kicked in. The organized left, which is the base of PT party and has alliances with other left parties too, but it's been the base of the PT party since day one, meaning it's the labor unions, the teachers' unions connected to the CUT Union Confederation. Okay, which has 8 million members. It's the second biggest union confederation in the Americas. And these wonderful students' associations, like the UNI, which is the National Undergraduate Student Association, which was formed in 1937 to fight the fascist new state of Getúlio Vargas and was outlawed during the military dictatorship. They started organizing the National High School Students Association and the National Graduate Students Association all started having these democratic assemblies in hundreds of cities across the country about how we're going to plan these protests. And so on May 15th, they put over 1 million people on the streets of 200 cities across Brazil.
Wow.
Okay. And they staggered it. So it started in the smaller towns, you know, so as the day progressed, you saw bigger and bigger cities on the news putting more and more people on the streets. So the morning started with towns like, you know, Caruaru, population 300,000, Pernambuco had 50,000 people on the streets, right? So this was amazing. And after that day, Bolsonaro announced, without showing anything on paper, that they were going to reduce the amount of cuts by 25% to try and like break the momentum of the protest. But nobody buyed it. And so Bolsonaro called his supporters out on the street for this counter protest, which completely fizzled out. They put people on the streets of like 50 towns across the country, but many of these protests only had a few hundred people in them. And the biggest one in Rio de Janeiro, in Bolsonaro's stronghold, you know, that they had like 40 or 50,000 people, but the student protest on May 15th put 300,000 people on the streets in Rio, right? So the Bolsonaro people managed to put 50,000 people on the street. The Guardian created a false equivalency between these two protests as if they were equal size. And I saw this happening in a lot of media and a lot of Twitter. I even saw people associated with leftist publications in the U.S. who went out personally to the right-wing protests and took pictures and said, oh, these people don't seem to be so right wing. They don't seem to be so radical. But the protest was calling for shutting down the Supreme Court and shutting down Congress, like the Nazi protests in Germany in the early 30s. That was the goal of the protest, because the Supreme Court and Congress are fighting with Bolsonaro. You know, so then, just to finish up, they had the second one, and a lot of people were like, oh, is it going to fizzle out? Will it be as big as the first one? And it was as big as the first one.
And those were this past weekend.
Another million people on the streets. Then, on Saturday in Sao Paulo, they had the Marijuana Rights March. 50,000 people on the streets booing Bolsonaro. And on Sunday, they had the Free Lula Festival. 80,000 people on the streets yelling Free Lula. And on June 14th, there's going to be a national general strike. All public transportation shut down. All factories shut down. The last big one, 35 million people didn't go to work that day. But the difference between the general strike in 2017 and now is that all of the students are on board. The last general strike, which successfully blocked President Temer's attempt to reform the pension system, didn't have adhesion from the students. This is going to be so what's so great about it right now is it's the students and the unions together on the streets of Brazil. You know, and they're not just protesting on the streets. They're pressuring local lawmakers. They're holding democratic assemblies and public meetings in neighborhoods around the country, explaining to people what these reforms would do to their lives. You know, it's not just you can't just put people on the streets anymore, because the media will always lie about the crowd size if it fits their needs. So this is a combined action that's very well organized and very inspiring.
Well, that's something else I wanted you to elaborate on. And I do just want to note, and I would, you know, the coverage of The Guardian and the New York Times and The Washington Post and the BBC remains just absolutely abominable. I mean, we'll get to it later, but I was making the point, please watch the conversation I had about Lula, specifically with Anna Kasparian on the Young Turks. And, you know, what I've been saying regularly on both that interview and on my show and on this show is, you know, even, and of course, I think the charges against Lula and the persecution of him is 100% politically motivated, and at the very end, there's a lot of complexities to understanding what is and isn't corruption and how these things function or don't function, particularly in the context of capitalism and so on. But to make a really simple point, when you read a report, in an example, The Guardian and The New York Times, they'll still say that Lula was convicted on money laundering charges regularly or charges related to Lava Jato. And what's incredible is that even according to that metric, that is in fact not true. He is convicted on a gifted apartment charge, which has, we always say, it has no material evidence. It's based on one plea bargain testimony. But even before we get to that, how ridiculous the case is and how it would be thrown out in any objective judiciary, the fact that it's still reported as being convicted of another charge just attests to the relentless failure of these media websites in dealing with Brazil.
Yeah, let me just give you another example of how ludicrous it is. Let's imagine that he actually did get this apartment as a gift. It happened after he left office.
Right.
Even though they can't prove it happened, the dates they were talking about were after he left office. So how is that corruption? Right. If you're not in a position, in a political position, you're not a public official, someone gives you an apartment, even though he never visited it, they never prove that it was ever registered in his name, never set foot in it, no evidence. But even if he had, even if he was living in this apartment, you know, it happened after he had left political office.
Which wouldn't violate, and then again, that's the point I would make then, is then we could say, okay, we would want to, you know, discourage that sort of behavior between companies and politicians. Then, okay, fine. Let's talk about Tony Blair lobbying for Kazakhstan and sitting on the board of JP Morgan. Let's talk about President Obama spending, you know, weeks at Richard Branson on vacation, and he and Hillary Clinton giving speeches to Wall Street. You know, okay, that's fine. That is a legitimate source of conversation, but then we got to talk about and deal with all of it, and particularly in a Brazilian context where there's endless actual serious allegations with material evidence for people like Michel Temer or Jair Bolsonaro.
Yeah, like, okay, in fact, it wasn't even the allegedly receiving the apartment that put him in jail, was receiving illegal, you know, receiving free reforms on this apartment, right, which they also were unable to prove had ever taken place. They said an elevator was installed, right, but the MTSC social movement invaded the building after Lou was arrested and took photos. There's no elevator in the apartment, you know?
Right.
But the value of this apartment, the entire value of the apartment, was less than half of what Obama charges for a speaking fee right now.
Right.
I mean, they froze all of Lula's assets. He had almost no money, right, considering he was president for 12 years. I mean, he's not like Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton. He's not a millionaire or anything.
Right.
You know?
No, it's people need to be very clear about what that case is. And there's one other new thing that we got to get to in a minute about it involving wiretapping and Sergio Moro. But before we get to that, I just want to say, because you were talking about these innovative tools that were being used by the Brazilian social movements in these protests. And I just want to say, too, you know, part of the reason that we have conversations like this is obviously, you know, a place, any country is an important in and of itself. But I really hope people in the United States are listening. And in addition to the vital importance of elections and defeating Donald Trump and electing good candidates, you know, don't forget the power of things like the teachers union strikes in West Virginia or the Chicago strikes and more of, and, you know, these things are incredibly important. So, in that context, can you give us a sense of some of the history and thinking behind some of these Brazilian unions and social movements that have allowed them to do this work so effectively?
Yeah, well, you know, I was really disappointed to see Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez talk about how her model for socialism is Northern Europe, you know, because there's so many good examples in multiracial, right, societies in the Americas of left unity and left organizing. You know, so these, Brazil has these incredible social movements that are connected to the unions too, but basically they rose out of the fight against the military dictatorship. Yep. During the military dictatorship, the only organization that was allowed to really mobilize people in poor neighborhoods was the Catholic Church. And there was some amazing work done by the liberation theology branch of the Catholic Church, where they would meet and conduct these adult literacy classes based on Paulo Freire and methodology and introduce local leaders to each other across cities and across the country. And of course, they were all excommunicated or censured by Ratzinger, you know, when, right, Jean-Paul II came in. But at the time, it was an important mobilizing tool. And so you have these groups that were most of these social movements. I mean, you have the unions and the social movements, two different things, you know, but they work together. But the social movements mostly still organize without using the internet, you know, because, and it's a smart thing to do because the internet is constantly monitored and surveilled and everything. And so it's harder to like infiltrate and, you know, hijack the meaning of a protest if you can't figure out what's going on because you're not a member of a cell. Right. Within this organizing group.
Right.
I mean, and I think that's something that maybe I don't know much about what's going on in the U.S. these days because we've been out for 20 years, but something that could be applied to organizing work in the U.S., less reliance on the internet. You know, everything you do on the internet's being,
right,
monitored. And, right, there's all this money invested in trying to get leftists fighting with each other all the time because it's so easy to do.
That's true. We got to always be working on our own internal cultures without a doubt. So that being, and this, I just want to, again, I'll plug it again. You know, when you read Brazil Wire, not only do you understand vital things like the U.S. Foreign policy, that will make sense of, as an example, go back to the Snowden revelations. Why was the NSA so aggressively tapping Dilma Rousseff? Not because they secretly thought the Workers' Party was some radical project, which in fact it was an incredibly positive and energetic one, but it wasn't. It was a good social democratic one, but they weren't willing to privatize core Brazilian geostrategic assets. That would be my guess why the NSA was tapping her so aggressively, as an example. But also when you read Brazil Wire, you'll have an understanding of things like the landless workers movement, and so on, and all of these other incredible pieces of organizing that, as you say, they're multi-identity, they're class-based, they're union-based, but they're also doing this real genuine socialist democracy that is, in fact, the highly directly regional model and hemispheric model for the left in the United States. So let's talk about it. Just in the last couple of weeks, Lula's been speaking and I think being clear again about, you know, just watching him, how, why he was such an incredible president, why he is such an admired leader. The Pope, actually, speaking of Pope of the Church, Pope Francis has actually written him a letter indicating, you know, I think as much as he can that he supports Lula. That's significant. Even if you are a religious person, that has a real significance in a country with such a high Catholic population. And also new revelations of the aggressiveness of wiretapping, that the prosecution team of Sergio Moro was illegally wiretapping Lula's lawyers and their conversations with Lula. And yet another example of how totally illegitimate this process was.
Yeah, basically Moro, who's been working with, in collaboration with the U.S. Department of Justice since at least 2009, we know, who headed up this joint U.S. Department of Justice, SEC, Brazilian Public Prosecutor's investigation, was allowed to act as a judge ruling on his own investigation with no jury. You know, he's broken a series of laws in the course of arresting Lula. And I'll just mention, like, yeah, it's so great that he's talking now. But when you see Lula talk, you understand why they had to shut him up for an entire year in order for Bolsonaro to win the election.
Yes.
They wouldn't let him talk. If he could have given one interview before the election, Bolsonaro wouldn't have won. And that's illegal. You know, they let TV cameras come in and interview mass murderers inside jails in Brazil, but they wouldn't let anyone interview Lula for a year. Okay.
Right.
So now the new thing that's come out, it's the second motion that the defense team's filed to dismiss the case due to illegal behavior on the part of Sergio Moro, who's now, you know, this far right wing justice minister trying to legalize cops' ability to kill people. You know, the first one was that a U.S. Department of Justice official was acting Attorney General Kenneth Blanco admitted on film that they'd had a series of informal talks with Sergio Moro's team in the lead up to Lula's arrest. And that's a crime in Brazil. Government agencies can't communicate with governments from foreign countries without going through protocol for security reasons. So that alone should have been enough to drop the case, you know, completely throw out all charges. But the new allegations, or the new proof that's come out, is that Moro wiretapped 14 hours of telephone conversations on 25 phone lines from Lula's defense lawyers between his defense team's offices and Lula. Mm-hmm. And they used this to create a kind of org chart to map out every possible move that the defense was going to do in advance. Mm-hmm. Now, this is unprecedented for a judge to do something like this. Valesca Martins, who's been on your show before, you know, she told me that the only precedent they've ever found of a judge wiretapping defense attorneys was a case in Spain where the guy was permanently debarred.
Yes.
You know, a few years ago. Like, you don't have a functioning democracy if the government is allowed to wiretap defense lawyers.
Without it. And again, this is also in the context, just a few more examples in the last minute. I mean, another thing that happened in the election again, and in this case it was dropped, but in addition to the misinformation and propaganda and lie campaigns on WhatsApp and so on, a couple weeks before the last election, there was a public revelation that Fernando Haddad was going to get charged with corruption. That had no basis. In fact, not only did that have no basis to it, a couple of weeks after the election, there was sort of quietly mentioned that actually those charges weren't going to go forward and there wasn't enough to the case. It just happened to be leaked in such a way to maximize the propaganda campaign against the Workers' Party. And going back to 2016, there's been illegal leaks from Sergio Moro, and in the most, I mean, just evil would be the only word. Amongst all of these sort of personal tragedies that Lula has been dealing with, in addition to the, you know, assault on Brazilian democracy and himself, you know, people might be aware that his grandson, who was 7 years old, died of meningitis. a couple of months ago, and they finally allowed Lula to at least go to the funeral. They took him there under total security guard in a horrific sort of dystopian image. Well, in fact, he pointed out, and you reported, that in one of these searches that Sergio Moro's team did, they took Lula's grandson's iPad and never returned it.
Yeah, they're just sadists. That's typical. Like, another thing, like, it's come out that Lula's got a girlfriend now. You know, his wife died
right
a couple of years ago. On, you know, she had an aneurysm on the day they raided the Moro's team raided her son's house.
Yep.
You know, because she was feeling so stressed out about all this stuff and died a few days later. So they found out Lula has a girlfriend. He's been dating this woman since a little bit before he went to jail, you know, right. And she's a public employee based right. in Curitiba. So the government found out and they transferred her 600 miles away so she can't visit Lula anymore.
Yep.
Like this kind of stuff. But just one quick thing regarding those leaks about Haddad the week before the election, that was Sergio Moro who did the leaks, okay?
Right.
And that alone is a crime. You're not allowed to talk about leak any information about investigations during the actual election campaign, like during the 2 months before the election. That's a crime. He committed a crime when he did that. But he was also lying because these accusations had already been thrown out. But, you know, they were reported in The Guardian
yep.
as if they were, like, legitimate accusations.
And just to, and the final loop on it, just recently there was a piece in The Washington Post as part of the internal conflicts. Part of the reason that Bolsonaro is having such a difficult time is that there's also massive internal conflicts and incoherence and incompetence that in some ways are analogous to what you've seen with Trump. And one of those factions fighting is Sergio Moro. And the Washington Post a couple of a week ago or so had a headline saying, you know, anti-graft, you know, prosecutor having trouble in new government or something, still giving this extreme far right wing, sadistic, totally unethical. And again, if you're the Washington Post, you can't say all those adjectives, but you at least have to start saying, you know, controversial prosecutor. That's the favorite word of the sort of neutral prosecutor. You're going to, you know, neutrality of a place like the Post. You better start seeing them using that type of language. And The Guardian has a reputation in some areas earned as being sort of liberal or center left. What abominable coverage they have of Brazil ongoingly.
Well, I'm just glad their mask of fake left, you know, and now coverage is fallen because of their atrocious coverage of Venezuela too. Right. You know, like right. now there's a lot more solidarity in the U.S. for Venezuela than there was for Brazil during the coup.
Yes.
And I blame the media and some of the left in the U.S. on this, but it's just become so blatant with Venezuela. I don't think very many people still believe that The Guardian's coverage in Latin America is progressive. You know,
no.
After that episode with John Pilger and Tom Phillips, where Pilger called Phillips a clown.
Brian Mayer, as always, I appreciate your time immensely. You can find the links, all the ways to follow Brian's work and buy the book, The Year of Lead, which is an incredibly important anthology. I'd really recommend everybody read that, with voices from Brazilian left, including also the former Brazilian foreign and defense minister, who Celso Amorim, I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that, but he has a brilliant read on also how all of these stories fit into the attempt to form basically alternative regional and international blocks of power, whether you're talking about the BRIC formation or other attempts at Latin American integration underneath the pink tide, which also, by the way, one of the critiques leveled at the pink tide, which in some cases is legitimate, in some cases just sort of saying a truism that you can't do much about, was that it benefited from a commodities boom. But in fact, regional integration and long-term strategy for the region outside of just being subservient to the U.S. would help absorb those shocks and diversify economies. So leaders like Lula and Chavez and so on were in fact working on that, and probably that is one of the reasons that the United States really started to aggressively re-engage beginning in 2009 with the coup in Honduras. But anyways, please read that. Read the Brazil Wire. Follow all of Brian's work also at Telesur. Brian, thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks a lot, man. Take it easy.
Much appreciated. Take care. Really big fan of Brian Mayer and his work. All right, folks. Become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. That's how this show is possible. That's how conversations like that are possible. That's how all of the conversations we have that are independent, left, global, deep dive, but also not playing to various dumb trends or sentiments either. I won't elaborate on that. But become a member of the Majority Report today. That's how it all happens. Check out justcoffee.coop, fair trade tea, coffee, or chocolate. Beautiful example in a lot of respects, in fact, of what someone like the great Richard Wolff is talking about. And while I'm at it, let me just say, if you haven't yet, go check out Economic Update on YouTube and on podcast. Richard Wolff is great. We're lucky. We have these people. I would say just one other, but say, I don't know, Bill Fletcher Jr. would be another great example of that, of people who really have a lot of experience and great insight who we can learn a hell of a lot from. So
I've been listening to Richard Wolff for a long time.
Definitely. Richard Wolff he's mishpucha. On Tuesday's Michael Brooks show, we had a lot of fun with Hassan Piker. I did a commentary on the European Union elections and how a left strategy would look, particularly in the UK. And then, if you haven't heard of Thomas Sankara, you need to know who Thomas Sankara is. He's one of the most inspiring figures we have in African and international politics, assassinated in a coup backed by the French in 1987. Brilliant figure. Milton Alamadi, another awesome, amazing journalist and historian that I want everybody to read and know about, was on. It was an incredible deep dive. And then the post game, we did a debunk with Ben Burgess. We have a new nickname for Pete Buttigieg, which is Pete Dumb Buttigieg, talking about his horrifically delusional nonsense Supreme Court plan, and many other things. This weekend, an illicit history with Rob Larson, going back to John Stuart Mill. It's called Capitalism versus Freedom. Become a patron, patreon.com/TMBS, because just like this show, TMBS is all about its audience and that direct content creation. That way, incredibly excited about what we're doing. Illicit histories from Silicon Valley to the history of Jamaican politics to theory primers on everyone from Marx to CLR James, patreon.com/TMBS. Jamie.
So this week on the Antifada, we have a collaboration with our friends Lexi and Grant from Swampside Chats. They're really cool. They call themselves the gayest, highest communist podcast. I haven't checked to see if that's true, but they're the gayest, highest one that I know of. We talk about communization theory, and communization theory is so intense that we're actually doing a series on it. It's called High Theory. Get it? And this episode, we talk about the 1974 foundational communization text, The Eclipse and Reemergence of the Communist Movement, written mostly in 1969 to 1972 by the Frenchie Gilles Dauvet. And I found it pretty interesting. I'm still wrestling with some of the ideas in there. I think my brain is still in recovery mode, honestly, from taking in so many high-level ideas. But check it out. Oh, I also...
Sounds awesome.
Yeah, I think it was pretty good. I mean, I'm biased. But yeah, I think people may find it interesting. It's definitely it's like a good way to reckon... It comes out of the left communist tradition. So it's a good way to reckon with the failures of the 20th century of various communist movements without abandoning the Marxist project.
Awesome. That's important listening. Of course, Matt does a great show called Literary Hangover, fascinating content on people like Margaret Fuller and George Orwell, it's also another history podcast. I'm really glad that everybody's going in so hard on history because it just couldn't be any more essential.
It's all so important.
All right, folks, we're going to take a break. We will see you in the fun half. Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?